Hello and welcome to session number 11 on hypnotic phenomena in our course on Ericksonian hypnotherapy training. I'm Dr. Richard Nongard, and I'm excited that you have continued to participate so that you too can learn how to speak Ericksonian. I hope that by now you've joined our Facebook group. You can find our Facebook group simply by searching ICBCH Ericksonian Hypnosis Training. It is a closed group. It is only available to members or students in this course, and it's a great place to interact with others to ask any questions. Milton Erickson was, of course, very interested in every aspect of hypnosis. That's why the collected papers of Milton Erickson span some four volumes, plus there are additional works and other papers that really aren't included in here that he had written in his time. Many different case studies, many different theories and ideas about hypnosis and the mind, as well as a tremendous amount of research. I think that Milton Erickson is associated with being a practitioner, not with being a researcher. However, he was a skilled researcher who undertook experiments in clinical hypnotherapy. This is why really the outgrowth of his work in the field of psychology formed two organizations. First, the American Society of Clinical Hypnotists, open to psychologists, medical doctors, dentists, and licensed mental health professionals, and the American Society for Clinical and Experimental Hypnosis. And as a researcher, he was particularly interested in hypnotic phenomena. In fact, Volume 3 of the collected papers of Milton Erickson focuses on the investigation of psychodynamic processes, and Volume 2 focuses on alteration of sensory, perceptual, and psychophysical processes. And that's really what we're going to focus on today in session number 11. Milton Erickson was concerned with the utility of hypnotic phenomena and with applications to the healing process. I think this, of course, was a result of his own experiences as a teenager with polio and his own medical complications that he struggled with throughout his whole life as a result of that episode of polio. And so healing medical conditions was certainly a focus of his work, and Milton Erickson knew how to utilize hypnotic phenomena to achieve those goals. I'm really excited because in a later part of this lesson, after I spend some time talking about hypnotic phenomena, Scott Sandlin is going to join me. And those of you who don't know Scott Sandlin, he's the director of HPTI, the Hypnosis Practitioner Training Institute, and also the owner of HypnoThoughts.com, the world's largest hypnosis social network. But Scott works full-time in a dental clinic doing dental hypnotherapy. And so I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking to Scott about applications of hypnotic phenomena in his work in the dental clinic. And I think really much of the work that Scott does on a day-to-day basis really came out of both the research and the practical methods of applying hypnotic phenomena that Milton Erickson developed. But we'll talk to Scott about that in a few minutes. Let me define for you what the hypnotic phenomena are that we most commonly associate with hypnosis. Now, it's really important for me to point out that there is no such thing as hypnotic phenomena that only occurs during hypnosis. That may seem like it really doesn't mesh up. Why would we call it hypnotic phenomena if it occurs outside of hypnosis? The reason why hypnotic phenomena occurs outside of hypnosis is that life is hypnotic. Hopefully one of the things that you've been getting out of this course is that you can be hypnotic in every aspect of your life. And because hypnosis is a natural phenomena that we all experience every single day, with or without a hypnotist, with or without a formal guiding process, at least trance is, all of the phenomena that we associate with hypnosis is also found in our everyday occurrences. And I'll talk a little bit more about that as I go through each one of these things. It may seem magical or mystical that they can occur during the hypnotic process, but really these things happen in all of our own lives spontaneously and really on a regular basis. In fact, if you're a parent of a small child, you already know how hypnotic anesthesia works. That's our first of the hypnotic phenomena that I want to sort of identify. And then after I identify these, I'm going to talk about how they might be utilized. This is blocking the sensation of pain. And if a parent of a 3 or 4 or 5 year old skins their knee, what do? They kiss the boo-boo to do what? To make the pain go away. So everything that we associate with hypnotic phenomena is really not something that occurs because of hypnosis, but something that we can direct the client to during the course of hypnosis because it can have utility and value in accomplishing our goals. But really, they are natural phenomena. In addition to anesthesia, which is blocking the sensation of pain, there is analgesia, think of aspirin, decreasing or numbing the sensation of pain or the avoidance of pain. A lot of people are sort of confused. What's the difference between anesthesia and analgesia? Anesthesia is blocking it. Analgesia really implies, to some extent, controlling the level of pain. Hyperesia, what is this? This is the abnormal increase in sensory perception. When I was a kid, I used to watch the $6 Million Man on TV. I know those of you who are young probably don't remember the $6 Million Man, but he was awesome. And he had, you know, a bionic ear and a bionic eye, and he could hear anything from miles away or see anything from miles away. And, of course, he could jump like a frog, you know, between buildings or whatever. It was really a really amazing TV show. This was actually, to some extent, the Hollywoodification of the phenomena of hyperesthesia, the abnormal increase in sensory perception. Age regression is another hypnotic phenomena that we can elicit during the hypnotic process. What I'm talking about here really is revivification. Not just recollecting something. We all know that we can go back in our memory and we can retrieve events. We can essentially see a movie, if you will, or hear the conversations of prior life events. This is really memory. What I'm talking about here is the actual ability to go back in time to a previous point and from an emotional and even a physical perspective, to revivify that, to actually become that age again. Let me share with you a time when this happened spontaneously in my own life, apart from a hypnotic process. I was very close to my grandparents. I lived with them when I was a kid. My grandmother lived to be 96 years old. And when she passed away, the memorial service was being held at the retirement center where she lived. And there was an aviary there. And for those who don't know what an aviary is, basically bird cages. And my grandmother was an avid bird watcher throughout her whole life. And when I was a kid, she would have her bird houses and bird feeders, and I would watch her watch birds when I was a kid. And every Wednesday in the months before she passed away, I went and ate dinner with her every Wednesday night, and I would sit with her in the aviary, and she would just watch the birds, and she loved those birds. So since the memorial service was held in the chapel at the apartment, retirement center, but, you know, for senior citizens where she lived, I was at the memorial service, and, you know, you always have all those family and people, and I guess I was just kind of tired of talking to people, so I decided to wander off, and I walked back to that foyer where that aviary was, and I was just standing there looking at those birds. And as I was standing there looking at the birds, I was recalling just the week before, when I was sitting there with my grandmother looking at the bluebird and looking at the yellow bird and looking at the white bird and all of the different birds in the cage. And she had names for each of them, and I started to recall 3 or 4 months back when she had told me the names that she had given to each of these birds. And I don't really know at what point I went from 3 or 4 months back to really 30 or 40 years back. And I was standing there, and literally, I was not recalling when I was 8 years old with my grandmother on her back porch watching the birds. I was revivifying that. I was, again, an 8-year-old kid with my grandmother watching those birds. I have no idea how much time went by. Was it 20 seconds? Was it 2 minutes? Or was it even 20 minutes that I was standing there? One of the nurses who cared for my grandmother, she saw me standing there looking at the birds. Of course, she didn't know what my experience was. And I got to know this nurse very well. And she came up and she put her hand on my shoulder. And that was a very nice thing for her to do, a non-shaming, non-sexual, affirming touch. She touched my shoulder, but man, it scared the hell out of me. I jumped through the ceiling. I screamed. And she, what's wrong? I said, oh my gosh. And I realized I wasn't eight. I wasn't on my grandmother's back porch. I was standing in the foyer aviary of the retirement center. So age regression is something that happens. Revivification is something that happens to us apart from the hypnotic process. We can actually use this as a technique in hypnotherapy. Milton Erickson often brought people back to an earlier point in life, but its purpose was not, and this is really important, to resolve unresolved traumas. That's Sigmund Freud's idea. It is Sigmund Freud's idea that we can go back in the mind, we can find the initial sensitizing event or the cause of today's problem, and somehow mystically or magically fix it or address it, or in Freudian language, have catharsis about it, and then move to today and be okay. There is absolutely zero evidence that Sigmund Freud's idea of regression and catharsis was an effective treatment modality. It really is always amazing to me that despite zero evidence for, you know, the initial sensitizing event and regression and catharsis as a method for effective healing, it's still probably the predominant method taught in hypnotherapy training programs, which always amazes me. Milton Erickson used regression differently. He would bring a person back to a prior point so they could gain new vantage points. NLP calls it first, second, or third perceptual position, to dissociate from something, or to fit into the context of today an understanding of our previous experiences, which is far different than searching for a cause of today's problem. In fact, when my client smokes, it's probably not because of some initial sensitizing event. If my client is stressed, it's not because of some initial sensitizing event. It's because life is stressful. Actually, one of the values in age regression is when we go back, we can actually see that there isn't a cause. We can give up the mythological search for an initial sensitizing event, and that can move us into acceptance for today. The reality is, in contextual psychology, the research in that area teaches us that we can change today despite where we've been before. So while Erickson certainly explored age regression, wrote about age regression, and used the concept of age regression, it was for a different purpose than Sigmund Freud or the hypnotherapy teachers that are teaching sort of what's called regress to cause hypnosis. Time distortion is a phenomenon that we've already spent time focusing on. Maybe you don't remember which lesson it was in. That would be an example of time distortion. Was that just earlier today or last week? Or was that in lesson 9 or lesson 7 or lesson 5? It's losing awareness of time periods and the relationships of various time periods. Dissociation is detachment from the environment that we're in, and a stimuli or awareness. And this is really important because often our clients become enmeshed with an emotion. Contextual psychology teaches us that we can observe an emotion. We can still have it and feel it. We're not trying to get rid of it. But we can be present with an emotion without becoming enmeshed in it or without following it. That is really a skill of dissociation that Milton Erickson talked about. Amnesia is the hypnotic phenomena of being without memory. If you've ever seen a stage hypnosis show, one of the things you've probably seen is the skit where the stage hypnotist will tell somebody you cannot remember your name, or they can't remember the number 2. And they can't remember the number 2, kind of a funny skit, because when they count their fingers, they go 1, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Right? They can't remember their name. And the stage hypnotist will often say, only when you think of that song, you know the one I'm talking about. Happy birthday to you, happy birthday to you, happy birthday dear. that's when you'll remember your name. What stage hypnotists do is they understand the ability of hypnosis to elicit phenomena, and they demonstrate that in humorous ways. As therapists, we can elicit this same phenomena for a therapeutic purpose. Hypermnesia is enhanced memory function. Now, this is really important. There has been a long history of using hypnosis in forensic psychology. Very few courts, because of the repressed memory syndrome episodes in the 1980s, accept hypnotically induced memory as testimony unless it is independently corroborated before a witness or somebody else is hypnotized. That's a very important legal concept that is probably present in almost all of the state courts in our country at this point. There were many people in the 80s who were falsely accused of horrendous things by unethical hypnotists who claimed that hypnosis was such a great tool for unlocking those hidden memories that and this was always truth. The research in this area has been done by a number of different folks, but my favorite set of research is actually from Elizabeth Loftus at the University of Washington. And in her research, she, of course, writes that the mind, the memory, is not like a VHS tape. And she wrote this a while ago. Or like a movie. And it doesn't just simply record everything. There are bits and pieces of memory which are not intact, that are not recallable. And the psychological evidence shows that when the mind cannot recall, the creative mind will create. Which is why two people from the same family can have two entirely different recollections of what it was like growing up. The reality is there are applications of this phenomena for enhancing memory, for test-taking, for vocational testing, performance-related issues. But from a perspective of forensic hypnosis and memory retrieval, hypnosis has not been particularly reliable in the high-profile cases in the 80s, really almost did in the hypnosis industry. Positive therapeutic hallucination is seeing what is not present. This is where the hypnotist will give the suggestion that something that is not present is actually seen by them. A negative therapeutic hallucination is the opposite of that. It's not seeing something that is there. By the way, this happens to all of us. Have you ever had this happen? Where is my TV remote? I've looked everywhere for the TV remote. You ask, whoever it is you live with, your partner, your husband, your wife, your kid, your roommate, whoever it is. You're like, man, I have torn the house apart looking for the darn remote control. Where is it? And they walk over to the middle of the coffee table. They pick that sucker up and they say, it's right here. And you say, oh my gosh, I can't believe I missed that. Catalepsy is induced muscle rigidity. Most people are accustomed to seeing a stage hypnotist have somebody make their hand at the beginning of the induction stiff and rigid, like a steel bar. No matter how hard you try to pull your hand down, the hand will not come down. And the stage hypnotist uses the ability to elicit this phenomena as a test for whether or not they're going to keep that volunteer on stage or not. Of course, if they're eliciting that phenomena, they're, according to the stage hypnotist, probably going to make a great subject, so they usually keep those folks. We can also use this phenomena, though, in clinical hypnosis, and I'll talk about how we utilize these phenomena here in a moment. Arm and levitation I covered in a previous session. Time distortion may have lost track of which session it was again. It wasn't too long ago, but in arm levitation, any levitation, our clients respond to suggestion, and it's an autogenic process. It really is something they create from within. And the last of the hypnotic phenomena I'm going to talk about is post-hypnotic suggestion. This is where a suggestion is made to a hypnotized person that specifies an action that's going to be performed after awakening. Often in response to a cue, particularly in stage hypnosis, but in the scripts that I use with my clients, simply because today is a new day. And that is enough of a cue to elicit action on the suggestions which have been made during clinical hypnosis. So what are the therapeutic applications of these things, and how would we elicit them? Well, anesthesia certainly is useful in emergency medicine. It is certainly useful in dental surgery. It is certainly useful in the management of chronic pain. When I spend some time here in a few minutes with Scott Sandlin, I'm going to ask him, how do you elicit anesthesia with your clients? What kind of trance process is necessary? Does it take a long time? Can it be done in a short time? And is it something that most clients can accomplish? Analgesia, same thing. I'm going to ask Scott how he elicits the phenomena, but this is a useful technique with acute pain or temporary pain. Hyperesia can be used to help a client engage in a new experience, to gain a new perspective, to enhance learning, and to tie those learnings to specific anchors. Probably the easiest technique here is I explain to my clients during trance. I give them this suggestion. So I don't really explain to them. I actually give them this suggestion. Here's an example. Right here in the chair, you know that you've been able to access parts of the mind which have always existed and are always with you, but not something you usually access each and every day. For example, you were able to recall this or recall that. The mind has an amazing capacity to bring to the forefront almost anything that it needs to. And of course, we know that you've prepared for this exam, you've studied the books, you've read through the courses, you've done exactly what you needed to do, even attended the lectures. And so because of this, you'll find when it comes time for the exam that all of those learnings are at the tip of your tongue or at the tip of your pen. They're easy to type, they're easy to access. Something you won't struggle with, but something you'll find natural and as effortless as this process of hypnosis. Age regression. Where do I use it? Well, I do use it in grief work. There is a great video. I'm going to embed a link in the PDF that I created demonstrating Steve and Connie Ray Andreas's grief resolution process. And regression is a great way to take a person back to that previous point to identify the things that they need to process grief in the present. Now, this is not about going back and resolving unresolved grief. That's what Sigmund Freud did. This is about taking tools from our past experiences and then bringing them back to the present. I use age regression with my smokers coupled with amnesia. I bring them back to a point before they ever had a cigarette, and then give them the suggestion that it is now as if they've never had a cigarette in the first place. Essentially, they create false memories. I bring them back to a point before they ever had their first cigarette and then imagine life as if they never made the choice to have a cigarette. I even say to them this. I say, it may of course seem bizarre to recall things not as they actually were, but it's amazing how the mind has the ability to do that. How you can see yourself in your car, or the apartment where you lived, or the school that you attended, and the places that you were with the people you were with, but for some reason, as if you never had a cigarette in the first place. And whatever the mind can conceive, the body can achieve, and so it is as if you've chosen never to have a cigarette in the first place, finding that, of course, the idea of withdrawal is something absurd, because people who have never smoked, never experienced withdrawal. I use age regression sometimes with confidence to draw on prior resources to show my clients that they had the capacity to be happy or be satisfied or be confident. Sports performance, same thing. Time distortion is used by the clinical hypnotist to induce confusion as a proof of hypnosis. And as I mentioned earlier, I use it often with my clients who are afraid to fly. Dissociation is a way of creating new perceptual positions. and amnesia can be used with my smokers and my food addicts. I don't know who came up with this suggestion, but it's always been one of my favorite suggestions. I give this to smokers all the time. And from this point forward, no matter where you go and what you're doing, you will find that you forget to remember to smoke in situations where you used to smoke. But if you don't forget to remember, then you will remember to forget to smoke. And of course, either way is fine. It's a great paradoxical forced choice suggestion. Hyperamnesia can be used with students, professional exams, and again, the area of forensic hypnosis, memory retrieval, is not an area that Erickson taught or talked about. Positive therapeutic hallucination can be used to heighten and create new experiences, such as the crystal ball technique I shared with you in lesson number 2. And negative therapeutic hallucination is a way of helping a person to gain control over negative experiences. Catalepsy is a great way for directing energy, tension, and anxiety. I will often have my client make a fist and let their arm become stiff and rigid and hold it out in front of them and have them bring everything known or unknown through that rigid, stiff arm. So stiff and rigid, it's as if it's being held up by 2 bridge cable wires. And bring anything known or unknown, keeping them from success to that point at the end where that hand is. I ask them when they're ready to release it, to cut those cables, to let that hand fall down, relax, deeper, 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 letting go completely and totally of anything known or unknown they were holding on to, keeping them from success. The arm levitation is a great convincer. It can be used to demonstrate internal power. This is really important for my pain control clients, my eating disorder clients, who need to learn experientially that they have the ability to control their own bodies. Of course, post-hypnotic suggestion is all about encouraging future action. All of my clients get post-hypnotic suggestions. One of my favorite ways to phrase this is, and over the next day or 2 or 3, or even the next 2 or 3 weeks, anytime, anywhere, you need the resources of this session, you can simply close your eyes, take in a breath, and bring yourself back to this place that you have created today. It's a powerful post-hypnotic suggestion. I'm going to take a couple of minutes here and interview Scott Sandlin. I want to talk to him about hypnotic phenomena because as an expert in clinical and dental hypnotherapy, he certainly has some tremendous insight for us on this subject. Well, I'm joined now by Scott Sandlin, and most of you know that Scott Sandlin is the owner of HypnoThoughts.com, the world's largest social network for hypnotists to gather, but he also is, in addition to being the administrator of HPTI, the Hypnosis Practitioner Training Institute, he's a full-time hypnotist in private practice, and he works in a dental clinic. And because we have been talking, Scott, about medical applications of hypnosis, anesthesia, and analgesia as trance phenomena, I thought you would be the go-to guy to talk a little bit about your work. So what kind of work are you doing in the dental clinic?
Well, you know, I've been doing dental work or working in a dental office for a little over 10 years now. So, and it's evolved over that time. In the beginning, it was more fear and pain based. And over there, you know, it didn't take very long for us to realize the best utilization was for chronic pain and teeth grinding. So absolutely, more of what I'm doing is, you know, either behavioral modification or, you know, chronic pain control from the teeth grinding itself.
Now, in my course, I've been talking about, of course, the phenomena of anesthesia, you know, the applications, of course, emergency medicine, dental surgery, chronic pain, and the idea of anesthesia is stopping pain, and the idea of analgesia really is controlling pain. How do you use these phenomena in your work with the dental clients? Because I've had dental pain before, and it's awful. What kind of techniques do you use with your clients?
Well, there's a few things. You know, When I was first getting started, I was talking to Gil Boyne about this, and I was really excited that I was going to use hypnosis and anesthesia in as a replacement to chemical anesthesia in a dental office. And what he told me is what I found out to be true, which is simply that the dentists are really used to using the chemistry and the drugs, and the stuff works pretty darn well. So with rare exceptions, that's not where where our tools are best suited. I've done hypnosis for tooth extractions or wisdom teeth or fillings or whatever a handful of times, but more to the point, it's they know how to give an injection, count to 90, and then get to work, so they don't need us for that.
But I actually have to admit that I had 4 wisdom teeth extracted using self-hypnosis rather than chemical anesthesia. And after my experience, I wouldn't recommend that to anybody.
Yeah. I mean, I've done it for myself with a filling, and it was no big deal and it was easy. But, I would recommend chemistry for the average person, if they don't have any allergies or chemical dependency history or anything like that. I would recommend, the standard way that everybody's been doing it with the drugs for most
and
people.
That would be my recommendation too. But, it's interesting you say, well, I'm not using anesthesia and analgesia as techniques for dental surgery because they're good at chemistry. I think that, that may be the perception of a lot of people who initially go into the subject. Without a doubt, though, you have to be drawing from this phenomena in your post-treatment work for helping people to learn how to control pain on their own, reducing the pain and even eliminating pain that they might have post-surgery when they're not experiencing chemical anesthesia.
Completely agree. Post-op stuff is much more practical. Post-op stuff and anything that's chronic in nature. So procedure-related, less, except for post-procedure. But yeah, there's a lot that you can do very conversationally. And in this class, I'm sure you talked about the fact that Erickson wasn't only conversational.
Sure.
But, there is a lot of stuff that is, what the cliche idea of what Ericksonian is. There's a lot of that can be done really easily for pain control work. And the easiest way to explain it is just, basic submodality shifting.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on go ahead.
No, I was going to ask, how do you go about shifting those submodalities? What do you mean by that? Can you define that a little bit?
Sure. Anybody who's got, some NLP background, the 5 senses and looking at those, and different people are going to have different strengths and, predilections for which of the 5 senses they're more used to using as a predominant sense. But, visual, auditory, kinesthetic being the primary 3 for humans, you understand the way that they're interpreting the pain, whether it's as a visual thing, an auditory thing, or a kinesthetic thing. And it sounds weird to think that it would be anything but kinesthetic, but it very well can be, and often is. And you change their descriptors of it rather than trying to change the direct suggestion itself. So, just to think of it in terms of if you can get somebody really quickly from a 0 to 10 pain scale, from an 8 to a 4 or a 5 with a couple sentences, you've got the buy-in you needed to get even further reduction. And simple conversational techniques of submodality shifting, which are often used, if anybody wants to do a quick online search, mostly they're used as, fast phobia and, phobia removal techniques and things like that. If you just replace the word fear with pain on your basic phobia script, you've got a good idea and a start on how to be doing pain control conversationally.
And that, by the way, is probably worth the price of this course alone. Scott, you giving us that tip for those who weren't aware of the interchangeability of these different experiences we have. You also touched on something that I think is really important related to this course. People have this impression that Milton Erickson was conversational, that people never knew when they were entering or exiting trance. It was all just him talking. And frankly, he did a little bit of both. Some clients he never used formal trance with, and other clients he did a process that might be very similar to a recognizable induction, deepener, suggestive therapy, post-hypnotic suggestion, and awakening. Do you find that you are using sort of a mix of both formal trance as well as conversational hypnosis with your dental clients?
With all my clients, absolutely. I think it's a right tool, right job situation, and there are times where just using the sentence, you don't need hypnosis, this is going to be way easier, watch this, is, you know, the process in and of itself. And that's most of the ritual, is just getting the person to, you know, relax and say, oh, this isn't going to be so tough. They let their guard down, and all of a sudden, you know, healing takes place when they start relaxing.
Hey, you just alluded to something else that's really important, and that is, I liked what you say to the client. This is going to be way easier than hypnosis. Let me teach you this. What percentage or how much of your hypnosis do you think is actually teaching rather than you doing something to your clients?
Okay. Well, for me, I know the problem that I tend to have is wanting to do too much because, you know, I know years worth of experience, but the client doesn't need years worth of experience. They need an hour's worth of experience. So for me, one of the problems that I have is trying to do too much. So one of the nice things about giving, you know, skills training and tools training is it's easier to limit that for me. So especially in pain control, what I like to do is in a single session, I like to give them one technique that's a takeaway, whether it be, you know, as a handout or as an MP3, and I have both. You know, I might try a couple techniques in the room, but I want to just have one be the takeaway and just pick one. And then next week we'll do another one as needed and give them tools that they can play with. Because if I give them five or six, it's overwhelming to them. So, you know, pacing out the how you dole out those techniques. But I think it's an important part in terms of especially with pain control to get them to feel and to be empowered and back in the driver's seat.
Sure, absolutely. Hey, you mentioned something else that's great. You know, I could probably talk to you all night long, but then we'd have a five-hour course on pain control. Hey, I guess you actually have a five-hour course on pain control, don't you?
We have a four-week course on pain control and medical hypnosis that's coming up in a couple weeks, actually.
Through HPPI.
It's taught with me and Michael Elmer. So it's 2 weeks of me alone just teaching techniques, and then 2 weeks of Michael and I talking about the application of that and demonstrating it.
Well, that's awesome. So there's lots of opportunity to learn these things more in depth. But you said something that was really pretty cool. You give your client homework assignments. You send them with a takeaway, something that they can do. I'm sure that of all the people listening to this course right now, there's somebody in my group who's experiencing some pain, who's having some difficulty. What's sort of one self-hypnosis technique or simple idea that might bring that person some significant relief that you could teach them today in the few minutes we have remaining?
Sure. So, you know, the standard disclaimer of don't do it if you haven't been diagnosed and all that. But that aside, let's assume that whoever's got that issue has a pain that's more than a 3 and less than a 9 on a scale. And this is a great technique for something in that ballpark. And it's basically a fractionation. So the idea is turn it up and make it worse, then turn it down to make it better, and you back and forth that process. And the reason you do that is because people in pain have two fears. The first is that it can't be controlled, and the second is that it's going to get worse. But if you look at that correctly, that creates a double bind, where you make it worse, which they expect can happen, and because you made it worse on purpose, that means it can be controlled. And so you move in that direction. So the idea is, anybody can just go with this right now. I want you to just take a mental image of your discomfort, you know, a physical, visual thing. And it can be a little thing like, you know, a person, it can be a red ball, it can be fire, it can be whatever it is that makes sense visually for you for that discomfort. I want you to imagine it 3 to 5 feet in front of you, just sitting right there, right in front of you. And just kind of notice what that feels like and what that experience is like. And then what we're going to do is, in a moment, we're just going to go ahead and make it worse by bringing it closer to you. So rather than it being 3 or 4 or 5 feet away, just have it start becoming 3 or 2.5 or 2 or 1 foot away. Bring it all the way so it's 2 inches in front of your face. And as it gets closer, it gets bigger. As it gets bigger, it gets worse and more intense. And then go ahead and just pull it back away. And instead of pulling it back away to 4 feet, pull it back away to 8 or 10 feet. Let it sit there for a minute. Just notice that it's better there. Bring it closer again. When you're ready, all the way back up to 1 or 2 inches away from your face, right in front of you, dominating your field of view, dominating your senses. And when you're ready, pull it back away to 8 to 10 feet again. And when it feels better there, calibrate on a scale of 0 to 10 what it feels like. And do that one more time, bringing it all the way in. And this time, when you bring it out, throw it as far away as you want. And that's as simple a technique. And, you know, you're just modifying the sensation. You're modifying its proximity. And that's something a person hasn't really thought much about. So something as simple as that is make it worse and make it better.
Absolutely. Excellent, excellent, excellent strategy. Scott, I am going to add you to our, we have a secret group on Facebook called the ICBCH Ericksonian Training Group. I'm going to add you to the group because somebody might have a question or two from the great Scott Sandlin. Thanks for taking some of these questions. Now, we really appreciate you answering some questions today in your area of expertise. So thank you very much. Appreciate it.
You bet. Always happy to help you. I love what you're doing.